And we'll just, for those of you that came over 100 miles, we'll take you first. So that would bring up Ken Cummings and Phil Adams, if they would come forward, please. You'll start off.
Sure.
You need to identify yourself.
Yeah. Hear me okay? This is I'm Kenneth Cummings, and I'm the Southern Oregon Regional Manager for Forest Capital Partners. Appreciate the opportunity, Chair Devlin and committee members as they show up.
Just a substitute for you're, a good senator.
Okay.
Representative Corbett.
Oh, okay. Okay. Good. Good. Appreciate the opportunity to be here before you today. I represent the Emergency Fire Cost Committee in the state of Oregon that oversees the Oregon Forest Land Protection Fund. I'm a member of that committee, past president and treasurer of the Rogue Protective Association, and as a company, we represent over half the associations in the state of Oregon between La Grande and Central Oregon up here in Southern Oregon. So we're pretty invested in the process of working with Oregon Department of Forestry. I'm here today to reaffirm the value and effectiveness of supporting these local budgets submitted at an adequate level for initial attack and just the whole process in Oregon of building a complete and coordinated suppression system. And it's truly dependent on partnerships, preparedness, and aggressive initial attack. And the partnership piece is basically why I'm here today, to come up here and just reaffirm that we're in it for the long haul, we've been in it for the long haul, and it's about relationships and making sure that we're as effective as we can be. The budgets, of course, are about preparedness and making it possible to have good equipment, train people, and be on top of the game when it needs to get played. And the aggressive initial attack is what the state's all about, and it's just sheer effectiveness and outstanding results, and it's one of the premier fire systems in probably the world. It's recognized all over. And while a lot of the press every summer gets focused on suppression costs in Oregon, as a landowner, we're much more focused on minimizing loss. And for instance, in 2002, we had a small fire in southern Oregon called Timbered Rock, and in 15 days we spent about $12 million, which was a big deal. But as a company in the prior life that I had in the ownership before Forest Capital, our losses exceeded that, clearly. And so it's pretty easy to lose a lot of value in a very short period of time. When you look at House Bill 2327 from the last session, the effectiveness of the state is incredible. When you look at other agencies, the state of Oregon handles about a quarter of the fires that happen through the year, but it only represents about 10% of the acres that get burned. When you look at the Forest Service, they handle about a third of the fires, and almost half the acres are on Forest Service. And the wisdom of preparedness is really evident when you look at the data over the last 10 years. The state meets or exceeds their goal of trying to keep fires under 10 acres 95% of the time. They're really good at what they do, and it's really less than just over half a percent of the fires that are almost 80% of the cost. So it doesn't take much to get over 1,000 acres in a really quick. And again, the loss piece is certainly timber values, but then we get into wildlife habitat, water, air quality, all the things that go with dead trees. And the value of having budgets like this that help the state be prepared is really evident. This spring we went to the insurance carriers on the fund, and they were very successful in convincing and looking at the insurance carriers, particularly Lloyd's of London folks, about just the commitment from the legislature all the way through to the oversight of landowners and how involved we are, that we realized a 19% reduction in the insurance premiums, which again goes half back to the general fund and half back to the emergency fund. So that's just a really great testimony in terms of how this program looks to the outside world, and a lot of those folks are overseas. They are not national. Inflation continues to erode our ability to be, our collective ability really, to be dedicated, and the whole program's at risk that way. And so I just really want to be able to emphasize how important it is to maintain the solidarity of the budgets as proposed and just help them be as efficient as possible. And I respectfully encourage you to continue that system as it works. And just if there's any questions I can answer, I'll be here. I appreciate the opportunity.
Any questions of Mr. Cummings?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just on the difference between the state and the federal, I mean, in this third paragraph, you indicate that 25% of the fires, but only burned 7% of the acres, and 36 and 45 for the feds. From your viewpoint, what is... Why is there so much of a difference? It seems like
we have a totally different philosophy in the state of Oregon than our federal partners a lot of times about the urgency of initial attack, the value of the timberlands, and those kinds of things, and oftentimes just results in a different approach. And fire is no respecter of property lines, and once it gets going, it's just not very easy to catch up. So it's largely philosophical in an approach about how we do business.
Mr. Adams.
Good morning, Chair Devlin, committee members. My name is Phil Adams. I'm a district forester with Roseburg Forest Products, headquartered out of Dillard, Oregon. And I'm also a current president of the Coos Forest Protective Association, which is one of the three operating associations in our system of fire protection with Oregon Department of Forestry state districts. So I'm here today supporting House Bill 5024. The goal of my testimony is to ensure the subcommittee has an understanding of the partnerships and collaborative activities that occur at the local district levels, and I'm associated with that. And I think my perspective is valuable because, like Ken, Roseburg is heavily invested in private timberlands in this state. In fact, we have 420,000 acres of forest land ownership, and within six of the nine West Side Forest Protective Association boundaries. Couple that with the fact that we find that one of our primary accountabilities is protection of our forest land base for the landowner. And you can see that we have a pretty strong dog in the fight here. And we think we have a great system that's working well. We want to voice that support. And I think the theme of the rest of my testimony is that we have a partnership that is working, and we call it "quote unquote" working together. It's phraseology that we hear all the time, but in our opinion, when you look at fire protection and the complete and coordinated system of fire protection in Oregon, we're a great model for that. And I wanted to just share three examples of that partnership, if you will, that I see in on a day-to-day basis at the local level. My first observation is that there's a tremendous amount of review and oversight. What happens at the end of a fire season from fall until this period of time is the board of directors of each association go through a review process with their district managers, looking at the previous fire season, what went right, what went wrong, what can we do to get better. And from that review process, we break down into smaller subcommittee groups and start analyzing and reviewing the various components of our organizations. And one of the primary committees that takes a look at status is the Protection Committee. And it's at that level that we really analyze the adequate level of protection that we're providing on each district. From that subcommittee or that committee recommendations, the district manager is able to work with his staff and develop the first draft of his annual budget to protect our concern or to show our protection concerns. As a board of directors member, what I wanted to ensure you is that we're not a rubber stamp board. Using CFPA as an example, we're given three opportunities to look at that draft budget as a board and review it, discuss it, brainstorm it, revise it, and finally, when we're comfortable that we've tailored it to meet our needs, we approve it and send it up the line. In fact, you know, as I talk to my colleagues and other board presidents, I can assure you they see the same process. And that's valuable and for us to understand that the budget, the wrap-up budget that you see today in the ODF protection from fire budget is the cumulative work of that, of those board of directors and association and district managers' work at the local level. Another area that I see the partnership really working well is in collaboration and execution of the fire season. Department of Forestry has the lead in execution of fire suppression efforts, but landowners don't just sit on their hands during the fire season. I think an important component from our viewpoint is collaboration, and that's where our partnership really hits the stride during fire season. When an example of that collaboration is to look at Roseburg's approach to supporting the system. Our company maintains a significant amount of resources and suppression equipment, and we also invest heavily in training field personnel to be qualified at a state level so that they can contribute to overhead teams. And the value of that, from our perspective, is not that we're trying to supersede the system, but we're trying to complement the system by providing resources that can quickly integrate and be effective when the fire bell hits. And we found that that partnership is working extremely well. And I wanted to report to you that although it's difficult for me to know exactly or describe the contributions from all other landowners, in 2004, OFIC, during the fire program review, conducted an interview or a survey of landowners. And they determined that over $6 million of in-kind contribution occurs annually from landowners in terms of fire suppression and readiness activities such as board participation, training, and supply of equipment, and other physical improvements on the land. So just those are contributions that are over and above our regular fees that and per acre assessments that we make. Another example that I wanted to bring to light was the partnership between landowners and the department in what I'll call our proactive phase, management phase, and that's particularly thinking of our fuel management programs. Fuel management and fuel reduction are an integral part of modern-day forestry, and it's this partnership between landowners who prepare their sites after harvest for transition back to growing planted forests through reduction of slash, and working with our local districts to provide us opportunities when we can use fire as our tool without impacting communities, that this partnership really of proactive management really takes place. You know, we also have been very active this year in the smoke management program review. Landowners have really pitched in and been actively involved in that process. It's the intent of that review is to provide direction with new community protection and weather forecasting tools that we can do our job better and still accomplish our goals. So just as an aside, I hope you, the committee, will support House Bill 3468 when it comes before you. Thank you. And also as an attachment, lastly, I've attached what is a pretty neat one-page synopsis of fire funding. And the value of that, of this summary, is it really gives you a big picture view of the integrated nature of fire funding in Oregon. It takes you through a scenario of a hypothetical forest protective district and how general funding is an integral part of that district's funding mechanism for adequate protection. Basically, the way it works, as you know, is that general funds are not a one-to-one match. They basically become, because of statutory laws and other, a three-to-one match. So a loss of $1 in general funds equates to a $3 loss in adequate protection at the district level. So that handout is a really slick way to see that. So that's my testimony. I thank you for the opportunity.
Thank you. Are there any questions? Seeing none. Thank you both. Thanks very much. We will now go to Mark Copeland and I believe it's Jake Gibbs. Oh, okay. Well, then we'll go to Mr. Gibbs and Mr. Geyer. And if you could limit your testimony to 3 to 5 minutes, it'd be
gladly.
Thanks.
Morning, Chair Devlin, members of the committee. My name is Jake Gibbs. I'm a forester with Lone Rock Timber out of Roseburg. We own and manage acreage in six southwest Oregon counties. Thank you for this opportunity. As the department and others have demonstrated to you, I'm going to talk to you, I guess I'll just summarize real fast. I'm going to talk to you about private forest program and fire and the protection from fire. Those are the two most important components of the forestry budget that I'm concerned with. The private forest program provides the expertise and personnel to implement the Forest Practices Act, which you are overly familiar with, I'm hoping. It protects values that are important to me for growing trees, but also protects water quality, wildlife habitat, and public safety. Reductions in this program have resulted in challenges to the department to meet those needs. I'm guilty of participating in making rules more complex for the department, asking questions of them to what are we really trying to accomplish with these rules and regulations. Unintended consequence of that is that it takes time and staff to address more challenging questions that the department currently does not have readily available because they have a variety of responsibilities. They've thousands of application notifications are coming in. There's operations occurring across the landscape. We have a more informed and interested public that like to contact the department to ask for more information about the activities taking place. So time is critical, and staff only has so many hours in a week. Opportunities are being lost due to some staff shortages in the field for these stewardship foresters. Programs like the Oregon Plan for Salmon and Watersheds are not reaching their full potential because the department is limited in its ability to facilitate with landowners on identifying places that we could do more for salmon in our watersheds. And I rely on that expertise to guide me on where I can do the best on that program. I also like to point out that the private forest program does receive funds. We're a partner in paying for this. It is a statutorily obligated 60-40 split shared between general fund and from our harvest tax. So, and this year we're going to see a significant increase in that that fee, and I fully support this arrangement and that. I understand the mathematics behind the formula behind the increase, and we support that. But I just want you to make that very clear. We get a bill as I'm lobbying for increasing staff that's going to impact my pocketbook. But it's the right thing. It's good. Protection from the fire program, real fast. Fire is bad for the forests of Oregon. A burnt forest does not meet my objectives, doesn't meet my neighbor's objectives. The department is looked to protect our forests, and it is imperative that they be funded effectively to help do just that. Two programs are very tightly linked, which is not necessarily, I don't think, is overly apparent. The private forest program relies on healthy forest growing to generate harvest dollars to keep those forests productive, to keep us interested in managing those lands aggressively and productively. That staff also is the staff used to fight fires when those times come around. And lately, these years, especially as I'm challenging the staff with more complex rules and regulations to meet things we're trying to accomplish, in the summertime, all those individuals leave because they have to go fight fire, and so things slow down. So funding or having adequately staffed private forest program directly impacts the ability of the fire program to be most effective. So while I realize that the Oregon's economy is better than years past, every agency is trying to rebuild, I would encourage you to invest in the Department of Forestry as a whole. It would be good for all Oregonians to do just that. And I guess my opening sentence that I didn't point out was that there's a drastic difference between the co-chair's budget and the governor's recommended budget, which doesn't support. So I'd urge you to challenge the co-chair's budget on that. Thank you.
Mr. Geyer.
Good morning, Chair Devlin, members of the subcommittee. My name is Eric Geyer. I'm a forester for Roseburg Forest Products. I want to thank you for the opportunity to comment on the Department of Forestry's budget. I will frame this in the context of value to all taxpaying citizens as you consider the relative needs of natural resource funds. Along these lines, I'll highlight a few essential values of the ODF budget. Like you've already heard, forest fires are an extremely difficult part of forest management for the entire state. They're a natural fact of life in Oregon, regardless of the current forest condition. Really, detection and aggressive action to fight fires quickly is an economically wise policy because large fires are always the most costly. This is a pay-me-now or pay-me-later reality and does not justify waiting to pay significantly more for large fires. The state cannot afford to underfund this essential program. Forests have many obvious attributes to citizens. Unfortunately, the public is often unaware of the scientific strides that have been achieved in forest management. Through studies, trials, and monitoring, sound forest management has become increasingly complex. The dynamic nature of the Oregon Forest Practices Act is a testament to this complexity. Forest professionals welcome quality science, and we seek to integrate new knowledge with current practices. The Watersheds Research Cooperative studies current forestry practices and their effects on entire watersheds. Since the WRC is housed at Oregon State University, funds to the cooperative are also funds to higher education. I consider this a double value and is an efficient use of my taxpayer dollars. Coinciding with reductions in the department's budget over the past few bienniums, notifications, written plans, and other paperwork have driven the remaining staff foresters to prioritize their work to the lowest common denominator, which is rule compliance and paperwork. In fact, we are aware of instances where reforestation rule compliance has not even been enforced. Examples like this undermine the otherwise strong and credible Forest Practices Act and are an obvious source of concern for all citizens. Adding to the already complex nature of today's Forest Practices Act, other societal changes have increased the demands on the department. Many of the newest citizens of Oregon are unfamiliar with our sound management practices and the science behind them. Increasingly, local stewardship foresters must interact with concerned neighbors and other members of the public, redirecting already scarce staff resources to these new roles. As a representative of Roseburg Forest Products, I fully support the mission with which the Department of Forestry has been entrusted. At a time when state revenues are up, it is important that significant additional funds be directed to the department to restore capacities that have been lost in recent years and to address the public's demands of property protection and sound management practices. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Any questions for Mr. Gibbs or Mr. Geyer? Seeing none, thank you both. We will now go on to Stuart Warshaw and Helen Ellis. And again, if you please limit your testimony to 3 to 5 minutes.
Senator Devlin and members of the committee, my name is Stuart Warshaw. I want to thank you for letting me testify today. I am on the Corvallis City Council, and I was here to testify on House Bill 5024. The letter that we're handing around was to express the City of Corvallis' support for the continuance of building funding for urban forestry activities and services that are currently provided to the Oregon Department of Forestry, ODF. The continued funding of these services is vital to help address the growing program delivery needs of the community forestry that exists in our city. We understand that the funding needed to support these services is being considered by the subcommittee for removal from the proposed budget, which is of serious concern to us. The technical and grant support that we receive from ODF has been invaluable to us to leverage the resources that supports our growing program. We strongly support the continuance of the Urban Forestry Program service funding, the ODF budget, and respectively request that the subcommittee final budget recommendations include sufficient funding to continue these services within the ODF budget. As a city councilor, I've been on there in 2001 to 2004, and now I'm serving another term. And during that time, I was liaison to what we call CBOT, City Beautification Urban Forestry, and Helen Ellis will talk about that program. What we have done at that is used money that we get from ODF to take our city money and stretch it farther, so the taxpayer is getting more. And we're trying to do that with other programs as well. Our concern is, as was mentioned earlier, that when we lose that money, we can't leverage like we did. And so the program goes to the wayside. We have also been, as an aside, I've been now liaison to the Open Space Committee for the Advisory Committee for the City of Corvallis, and we've been working on our open space areas that we purchased. One thing we've done is worked with the city, the university, to talk about how to rehabilitate wildlife habitats such as Oak Savannah. And so that's been very valuable, and part of their money comes through the ODF. But that's all I had to say for this. I thank you, and I'll take any questions.
Ms. Sellis.
Members of the committee, I want to let you know that I'm here to tell you that I've been for well over 50 years, I've been a volunteer in the city of Corvallis. I've been since 1980. I've been a city councilor. And now I am chair of the CBUF, which is difficult to explain to people because it's civic beautification as well as urban forestry. But we have a group of people who are so active that I can hardly contain them. And we're here to support the governor's recommended budget proposal, and we're really concerned about having you delete all urban forestry funding, because in our case, we do a lot of educating of the citizens. We have more than 200 people who help us on all of the different projects that we work on. We're doing things as unique as a program called Cement Concrete to Trees. Concrete to Trees. And on the sidewalks, we're taking out the concrete and putting in trees. And almost every week, I have a call from someone in the community who says, we need to plant more sequoia trees. And I report that sequoia trees are not urban trees. They are forest trees. And we need there's a big concern about the education of the citizens. We partner with Consumer Power, Pacific Power and Light, and the university and other people to do some of these big projects that we do. And the city and its citizens are very concerned about urban forestry. We have some really, really old trees on campus and in our parks that are, you know, they've come to the lifetime, the end of their life. We need to get those taken care of. We use the CBA funds for technical assistance, for grants for planting trees, for public outreach is the biggest thing that we do, and as well as for training staff and citizens in all kinds of training sessions so that they can have opportunities as well. The federal funds are not available for these kinds of services, and so here in the state, we're on our own. Federal funding is just doesn't seem to be available for the kinds of services that urban forest takes. So my concern is that we really would like to have you recommend that the subcommittee reconsider and include the small amount that it's shown that we need in House Bill 5024 to support the urban and community forestry assistance at the current funding level. And I'd be happy to answer any questions that you have.
Well, Councilor Ellis, would you please just, one thing I forgot, identify yourself for the record.
My name is Helen Ellis. I live at 3344 Southwest Willamette in Corvallis.
Any questions for Councilor Warshaw or Councilor Ellis?
Is there just a comment? It looks like it's 6-0 for the governor's budget over the co-chair's budget.
We're certainly not opposed to the budget, but we are opposed to the recommendation that came from a subcommittee.
Thank you both very much.
Thank you.
Chris Jarmer, and I hope I pronounce this. I can't read the spelling, but it
Mark Lampart. Looks like Lampart.
It's okay.
Lampart.
Yes, Tillamook County Commissioner Mark Lampart, and Chris Jarmer with OFIC.
Thank you.
Please proceed. Identify yourself for the record.
Mr. Chair, members, for the record, my name is Chris Jarmer. I'm the Director of Water Policy and Forest Regulation at the Oregon Forest Industries Council. I'd like to run the score to 7-0, if that's all right with you. I had several members already precede me in testimony. I won't go over the same things that they've said. I do want to say thanks for the time to testify. As you know, OFIC members own and manage over 5 million acres of forest land in the state of Oregon, and they contribute greatly to the forestry sector, which is a strong economic driver for the state. 70,000 jobs, more or less, above average wages. So I want to say that we think the future looks bright for forestry in Oregon, but part of that hinges on the department's ability to deliver their programs. And, I won't reiterate what's been said already, but Those programs have been cut in recent biennia, and we were encouraged by the governor's budget to reinstate some of that capacity. And as you know, that's not part of the co-chair's budget. So we're in support of the base budget from the department, governor's recommended budget, and would appreciate anything that you can do to reinstate some of the program option packages that the department brought forward. Finally, just reiterating again, a dollar lost in general fund is more than a dollar when you take into account that the landowners match some of those program funds. So just wanted to make sure that that's on the record. Appreciate the time, and that's all I've got.
Thank you, Chair Devlin. Members of the subcommittee, for the record, my name is Mark Labhart, and I am the chair of the Tillamook County Commissioners. I'd like to give just a little bit of background before I actually start my testimony so that you can see hopefully some credibility that I have in making some of the comments. I have worked previously for the Department of Forestry for 34 years. I was the district forester or the manager of the majority of the Tillamook State Forest for the last 20 years prior to retirement about 3 years ago. I have spent significant time dealing with ODF budgets, understanding ODF budgets and what it takes to implement an ODF budget. ODF did not ask me to testify today. I said I would like to come and testify on a specific item in the ODF budget in regards to state forest, and that is POP 130. POP 130, I'm not asking you to increase ODF's budget. I'm not asking you to decrease ODF's budget. I'm asking you to consider implementing POP 130, which in my opinion is something that has been continuing practice for quite a few years. POP 130 is the conversion of limited duration foresters positions to permanent positions. And you've got a copy of my testimony in front of you. I'll just quickly go through that. The history of limited duration foresters, in my opinion, is a revolving door. The Department of Forestry has been receiving, thanks to the legislature, limited duration positions for a number of biennium. It has continued for a number of biennium. This is not a new proposal. Foresters come into the Department of Forestry, and they know immediately when they come in the door that they are in a limited duration position, which means that in 2 years, their funding runs out, unless the legislature reauthorizes that limited duration position. And they are immediately upon getting in the door beginning to start looking for a permanent position. And that might be in another ODF program, which is a fire program or a recreation or service forestry program or something like that. Or they may even be looking for another agency, a federal agency or a private company, once they get their resume built. And you might say, well, that's not such a bad idea. They go on to bigger and better things. There is a problem with it, and I'd like to deal with it in three categories: timber sales, reforestation, and then specifically talk about recreation also. These students that come out of the colleges are fresh. They've got a lot of energy. They are ready to do good forestry things. And I was one of those students 34 years ago after graduating from Oregon State. I thought I knew quite a bit about forestry when I graduated, and I found out I didn't know a lot when I came to work for ODF. First, they teach you how to cruise timber differently than you may have learned at Oregon State. You need to learn the country in which you're operating. And in my case, Tillamook County, about half the county is state-owned, so it's a huge, huge area, thousands of miles of road, lots of terrain, lots of creeks, lots of steep country. So you need to learn the country and the road systems that you're working in. They need to learn the process to prepare a timber sale. It's a two-year process, and sometimes even more, from the start of the sale preparation to letting the contract or bidding out the contract. And then it's a up to three-year process after that in order to get the contract harvested. In order to prepare a timber sale, you need to listen to the public and incorporate public comments into that timber sale. You need to do road and landing locations, the harvest prescription, which varies on various sites.
There's right-of-way and sail cruising. There's threatened and endangered species survey that are very important that they do. There's riparian standard protections that they must implement. There's the type of harvest systems to use, and they have various harvest systems. They're very complicated nowadays. There's road construction contracts. There's covert locations, snag creations. There's insurance. There's bonding. There's existing road improvements. There's road maintenance during the contract. There's protecting stream buffers. There's timber sale haul road designations out of the forest. Estimating the sale value. There's seasonal work windows that they have to work with. There's contract administration of the loggers. There's branding requirements. There's reforestation standards. There's road closures after the timber sales. There's GIS mapping. And finally, the contract write-up. My point in bringing that to you, you just don't bring in a fresh forester off of a college degree, and it takes them a while to learn the ropes. It's also important that these new foresters learn the rapport with the contractors. Many of these contractors are long-term contractors, been around a long time. They really know their stuff. And that these new foresters build that rapport with the contractors when they are the ones that are administering these timber sales. And a lot of them say, well, who's the next new forester that's coming through the door that's going to be telling me how to manage a timber sale that I've been here for 30 years doing this kind of work? So it is something that you need to have a lot of knowledge and skills on. Reforestation. Students need to learn the terrain that they're working in. They need to learn the process from even collecting the seeds from the cones to the nursery operations, to which species to plant on the site, to the planting techniques, and various planting techniques vary, to the brush control, to pre-commercial thinning, to disease control, to managing the deer and elk populations. And recreation is something that is really taking off in the last few years, and particularly in the Tillamook and Clatsop State Forests. The Tillamook Forest Interpretive Center, which is something that I'm personally very proud of, and the citizens of Tillamook County are very proud of, it just celebrated its one-year anniversary a couple weeks ago. And I think the figures, if I have them correct, they had about 57,000 people go through the Interpretive Center this last year. And a lot of those were school children. So you have a limited duration recreation staff person that comes in right out of college, fresh, ready to talk about recreation, and they're immediately saying, well, I'm going to be out of a job in 2 years. I'm going to start looking for another job. They need to have knowledge and experience about recreation, where the trails are, what are the issues, what clientele they're dealing with, what's the history of the forest. So it's important, I believe, that we do not continue this revolving door of limited duration positions. And I fully realize the legislature does take flack when you add FTE, and a limited duration position is not a permanent position, and so it looks good when you say, well, we didn't add any FTE. But in fact, these positions are desperately needed in order for the Department of Forestry to achieve their mission. And those positions are routinely approved by every legislative session because it's important that these jobs get done. It's not any general fund dollars. It's strictly dollars that the Department of Forestry gets from either timber sales, camping permits, those kind of things. So the bottom line for me, and I think many people, and I think many foresters that probably aren't allowed to testify in front of you today that would like to, that are out there on the ground working with these young foresters, is the conversion to permanent positions. You keep the foresters doing the valuable work instead of leaving to go to work for private industry or other ODF programs outside of their state forest programs. And I know many of my private industry folks say, great, thank you for the training ground. You did a good job in training these young foresters, and now we'll take them and move them on from here. And that's not necessarily a bad thing, but it doesn't make the productive. It doesn't make the Department of Forestry productive, in my opinion. You save the state, you save ODF, and the county's money in the long run, because you're not constantly training these new employees. The ones who stay are more efficient and they're more effective. You get employees who may want to stay for the long term and make a career of the Department of Forestry, which I did for 34 years. You have knowledgeable and dedicated professional foresters and you also get fewer mistakes. A mistake in a timber sale can cost thousands, if not millions of dollars, depending on the degree of the mistake. And so you want to make sure when you're operating in this kind of a financial climate that the foresters know what they're doing and they do not make mistakes. Counties support long-term professional foresters who manage the land in the best interests of the state and in the best interests of the county. And I would ask you, when you're drilling down into the budget and looking at POP 130 to approve it, the conversion of the limited duration positions to permanent positions, and again, no general fund dollars, not asking for an increase in dollars, not asking for a decrease, just make the positions permanent.
Thank you. Any questions? Seeing none, thank you both. Thank you. Now we have two people from the Oregon Department of Agriculture, Lauren Henderson and Nancy Osterbaum. They're a whole mixture.
Good morning, Chair Devlin, members of the committee. Lauren Henderson, Assistant Director with the Oregon Department of Agriculture. We're here today. The Oregon Department of Agriculture fully supports the Oregon Department of Forestry's request for resources related to the control and eradication of P. remorum, or sudden oak death. Since the discovery of P. remorum in Curry County, the ODA has worked closely with forestry in dealing with this quarantine pathogen. We have provided the regulatory authority while forestry has used their expertise to carry out aerial detection surveys and conduct the eradication efforts on infested sites. Any break in the eradication effort creates a high risk for sod to escape the current quarantine area and cause significant economic impacts to the nursery, timber, Christmas tree, and forest greenery sectors. The Department of Agriculture would also like to extend its gratitude to the legislature for providing $300,000 from the state emergency funds to the Department of Forestry to continue eradication efforts through June of 07. At this time, I would like to introduce to you Dr. Nancy Osterbauer, who is the manager of our plant health section and works directly with the nursery and Christmas tree industry to provide certification services for P. remorum-free certifications. Nancy and her staff, along with staff from forestry, have been an important asset for Oregon to contain P. remorum.
Chair Devlin, committee members, my name is Nancy Ostbar. I am the Plant Health Program Supervisor with the Oregon Department of Agriculture. And it is critically important that we contain and eradicate Phytophthora remorum in Curry County. Currently, the USDA and several other countries strictly regulate products exported by the nursery, Christmas tree, and timber industries from quarantine counties. And where this pathogen is spread into the Willamette Valley and other coastal counties, we estimate that it would cost between $10 to $14 million a year to meet the USDA certification requirements to continue to ship our nursery and Christmas tree products interstate. Also, based on existing international quarantines, our timber companies would not be able to export Douglas fir and redwood to countries such as South Korea and Australia. Again, it's critically important to our agricultural and timber industries that we contain and eradicate this pathogen in Curry County. The best strategy for Oregon is to contain and eradicate P. remorum before it becomes widely established, as it has in Humboldt County, California. And we fully support forestry's request to secure the necessary resources to meet this goal.
If you have any questions, we'll be there.
Senator Nelson.
Does the co-chair budget cut this program out?
In the Department of Agriculture, the funding is there, and I do not believe it is cut in the co-chair's budget. In this budget, there is not a package.
That's correct.
Is that right?
So, thank you both.
Thank you.
Mark Snyder and Rex Storm. Please identify yourself.
Chair Devlin, members of the subcommittee, my name is Mark Snyder. I live at 5544 Wales Drive in Eugene. I'm here as president of Oregon Community Trees, a statewide nonpartisan nonprofit organization that's been promoting the healthy urban community forests since 1991 through advocacy, leadership, and education. I'm here today as an advocate to urge you to reinstate into the co-chair's recommended budget governor's proposals for ODS, Urban and Community Forestry Assistance Program, specifically and at a minimum the POP 140A, which is continuation funding that will replace federal funds that have been lost to the tune of over 40% in the last 2 years alone. This is a 3-FTE program that will be reduced July 1st without discontinuation funding to 2 FTEs, and expectations are for further federal cuts in the budget, which will result in a couple of years, probably a reduction down to 1 urban forester for the entire state. I've submitted a letter that you've seen, a one-page letter, and a presentation, a printout of a PowerPoint presentation developed by the U.S. Forest Service Center for Urban Forestry Research at the University of California, Davis. Oregon's Urban Forestry Department and Program is an efficiently run, nationally recognized service that provides technical assistance and matching grant funds to citizens throughout the state. You can read my short letter, which talks about the hard work of the 3 urban foresters serving the entire state, and the economic, environmental, and social benefits that so many communities have received because of this healthy urban forest and these matching grant funds. The slide prints summarize studies that have quantified the benefits of trees and have shown that when all benefits and costs are compared, trees in Oregon give back $2.70 for every dollar invested. Where have you seen that kind of a return on investment? I'd like to tell a quick story about myself personally that might tell you, give you some idea of why I'm here before you today, but it also might help inform you and help make you, give you better informed decision-making capabilities when faced with the tough questions that you have as budget people. And by the way, thank you for the hard work that you do. Doing budgets must be a thankless job, and I appreciate the hard work that you do. You might be asking yourself, why should I fund trees when people are saying you need to fund general safety, public health, public welfare, public education? I'm here to tell you that trees are crucial to the health, safety, and welfare of the public, and that community forestry programs help build better communities. My 28-year-old son, David, is graduating, finally, this June from the University of Washington. He started out 10 years ago majoring in math, physics, engineering, switched to music because he wanted to be an opera singer, studied music for 2 years and dropped out of school. Moved out here to Oregon, and after a year started attending U of O part-time in physics again. Almost completed a physics degree, finally decided it wasn't for him, dropped out of school again, moved to Seattle to be with some friends. After a couple years there, he called me a couple years ago and said, Dad, I found a program, he's all excited, that people just like me that have never graduated, if I take 2 classes a night for every semester for 2 years, I'll graduate with a degree in political science, and then I want to go to law school because there's too much social injustice in the world and I want to do something about it. So the guy's gone from a raging egomaniac to someone who cares about people. He reminded me of his old man, who in 1969 started out studying French, dropped out of school, almost got drafted and sent to Vietnam, but didn't. Studied English again, went back to school, switched to comparative literature, switched to German, was in a German honors program, could not find the money to study overseas, switched to pre-law. The pre-law advisor said to get a degree in general liberal arts, so I got a degree in American studies, but couldn't get a job in 1975 with a degree in liberal arts. Finally found someone at the Career Development Center who knew what she was about, started to ask me to ask myself the right questions. Instead of what do I want to be when I grow up, what kinds of things do you like to do? And it was through a process of self-introspection that I realized that what made me the person I was all the opportunities my mom and dad gave me growing up, taking us kids in the back, throwing us in the back of the station wagon, driving all over the country. I've been in every state in the union except Maine, camping in forests and campgrounds and state parks and national parks. And I figured if I could do something that would make sure that my children and their children had the same opportunities to enjoy the woods, hiking and camping, recreating myself. That's what recreation is all about. Especially as that was especially important as a teenager, being in the woods for me. If I could do that, that would be something worthwhile spending my life doing. I had a heartwarming experience last summer when my younger son, Brian, called me and told me that he had taken his 3-year-old daughters, identical twin daughters, Emma and Maddie, to the ice cream parlor at the University of Maryland. And as he was walking across campus, he was pointing out and saying to them, and Grandpa planted that tree, and Grandpa planted that tree, and Grandpa planted that tree. It reminded me of when I did the same thing 25 years ago and told them, and Daddy planted that tree, and Daddy planted that tree, and Daddy planted that tree. For me, it was all about the kids. It was all about children. And now it's all about grandchildren. So, do you want, as legislators, to improve public safety in cities for our children and grandchildren? Fund urban forestry. Trees lower crime and reduce domestic violence. Do you want to spur economic development in cities and make sure our children and their children have healthy economies? Fund urban forestry. Trees are good for business. They increase property values. People will spend up to 12% higher retail prices at well-landscaped and tree businesses. Do you want to create more livable neighborhoods? Fund urban forestry. Trees reduce stress, noise levels. They result in air pollution reduction and improve stormwater quality. Do you want to address global climate change? Fund urban forestry. Trees sequester carbon. They give us oxygen to breathe. They absorb carbon dioxide. They reduce heating and cooling costs, which further reduces greenhouse gas emission. Do you want to use a wise use of public funds and get a great investment with our tax dollars, fund urban forestry for a 270% return on investment? So for your Davids and your Bryans and your Emmas and your Madelines, support urban forestry, reinstate continuation funding for the urban forestry program at a minimum for our grandchildren's children now. Thank you for the opportunity to provide testimony. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Chair Devlin and subcommittee members, my name is Rex Storm. I'm a forest policy manager with Associated Oregon Loggers. It's an unusual occasion when I come to the Capitol building asking for more government spending, but here I'll go. I also support the governor's budget and going beyond the amount proposed in House Bill 5024. For the past 36 years, the Department of Forestry has garnered the confidence and the support of the private forest community, operators, landowners, and manufacturers alike, through the implementation of the nation's most Progressive Forest Practices Program. Each year, the Department of Forestry processes approximately 20,000 operation notifications while boasting a 98% compliance rate for commercial forest operations. This extraordinary compliance rate demonstrates the successful cooperative stewardship maintained by the teamwork fostered through private forest community, the private forest community and its governor, its government partner. Yet I'm here today to speak with alarm that the stewardship relationship and the advantage is in serious jeopardy. Each year, Oregon's bundle of forest regulations becomes more complex and costly to administer for all, the government and the landowner alike. And it becomes more costly due to the recurrent and administrative statutory upgrades that occur on a regular basis. General fund reductions over the past three biennials have slashed Department of Forestry staff and programs essential to maintaining this private forest program stewardship. Now is the time to restore the funding to keep Oregon's forests sustainable. And we need to work together to reverse the trend of unfunded environmental mandates on Oregon's forest lands. A summary of our recommendation is to support the governor's recommended budget, but to also add an additional $3 million above the governor's budget in particular areas. And let me list those five areas: the funding the Watershed Research Cooperative, second, Measure 37 claim processing, third, most efficient level firefighting, fourth, fire accounting redesign, and last, sudden oak death eradication. The two emphasis areas that I would like to emphasize would be restoring the private forest program. This budget would restore a minimum accomplishment level for vital programs. And the second area of emphasis that I'd like to highlight is maintaining the fire protection program. The governor's budget would simply maintain pace with the expenditure levels required for today's firefighting atmosphere. The rationale for our proposal is this: that there are many threats that must be addressed by the department. There are many opportunities as well. Oregon Forest Resources offer an abundant opportunity for the health and the wealth of our economy, environment, and social society. The forest sector provides upwards of almost 200,000 jobs to the state, and yet there's more potential to tap into Oregon's forest resources. The productive capacity of the Oregon's forests far exceeds the current harvest and management level. Federal forests in particular, federal forests alone fail to even harvest the simple mortality that occurs in federal forest land ownership. If 1 billion more more timber, 1 billion board feet more timber were harvested from the federal forest, that would generate approximately 16,000 jobs to Oregon's economy. And yet, the Department of Forestry at this point does not have the staff or the financial resources to coordinate with our federal forest land management agencies to help them facilitate an improved forest management of those lands. So one or two jobs of the Department of Forestry could leverage a significant economic advantage for Oregon. That's just one example. But in closing, I'd like to mention that stop loss is needed. ODF faces many challenges in its our forest climate and our forest atmosphere that it currently has insufficient funding to address. Let me just list and identify a few of those, but you have my written comments. Land conversion to non-forest uses, homes in the wild urban wildland urban interface, the failing federal forest land management, water quality and species habitat pressures on forest practices, just to name a few of those threats and financial challenges that the department faces. So in closing, I'd like to thank you for this opportunity to speak today.
Thank you, Bill. Any questions? Yes, Representative Flynn.
Actually, first I better ask, are we likely to not be able to make it through our entire list?
Yeah, we could probably make it if your question's short.
I want a little question. Did you say this was a U.S. Forest Service PowerPoint?
Yes, Representative Clinton.
I'll check with that. Thanks.
Thank you both. If people could limit themselves to about 3 minutes, we'll be able to make it through everyone on the list, maybe with a couple of minutes to spare. Merrill Reddish and Scott Fogarty.
Good morning, Chair Devlin and members of the Subcommittee on Natural Resources. My name is Merrill Reddish. I am here as a concerned citizen and board member of Oregon Community Trees, a statewide NGO that promotes sound urban and community forestry practices through educational activities, advocacy, and locally based grants programs. Presently, I am the executive director for the Audubon Society of Portland, and I also served as director for a statewide urban and community forestry NGO in the state of Utah. I want to thank Governor Kulongoski for including the line item for urban and community forestry assistance, and to the Department of Forestry and Board of Forestry for recognizing and including in their long-range plans, in their long-range goals and strategic plan, the importance of urban forests. These two acts are greatly appreciated and certainly welcomed by those of us who have long known the benefits of our urban trees and forest canopies. I want to highlight the urban and community forestry component of the Oregon Department of Forestry budget. Most simply put, our urban forests denotes all of the large living woody structures that exist in urban environments and in smaller communities. Primarily, these are trees that are part of our streetscapes, planted in backyards, parks, or along roadways. Many in the field use the term green infrastructure as one way to describe our urban forests. And while most people really like trees and see their aesthetic value, most don't fully realize the health benefits that are derived from them. And these benefits include clean air and water, benefits to native wildlife, reduction in energy use, alleviation of the urban heat island effect, aquatic health in watersheds, increase in property values, neighborhood cohesion, traffic calming, and so forth. Research shows that the aquatic health of our streams and rivers in our region relates directly to the extent of forest cover within our watersheds. The strong relationship between watershed tree canopy cover, water quality, and aquatic health results from the capacity of trees to control the quality and quantity of urban stormwater runoff. Forest cover also supports numerous native bird species. It protects and restores the urban forest canopy, is the one of the most important things we can do to improve the environmental quality of a city. comply with regional, state, and federal law, and safeguard public trust resources. Researchers and public health advocates increasingly recognize that the presence of urban trees and vegetation in urban communities improves child development, reduces crime, increases local business activities, lowers domestic violence, and enhances mental and physical health. For example, consider the role of urban trees in urban air quality. Today, a primary concern with urban air quality is the level of airborne particulate matter, and it's directly linked to asthma rates and human mortality. Trees and vegetation absorb air particulates and other pollutants through their leaf processes and photosynthesis. And the structure of trees, both deciduous and coniferous, also serve to adsorb or collect air pollutants such as dust by transferring it to the soil during rain events. Urban canopies play an important role in reducing ambient air temperatures and minimize the urban heat island effect. Energy costs to consumers, businesses, and government agencies can be lowered during summer and winter months with strategic planting and proper maintenance of trees. So this session, elected officials, you, can choose between two acceptable strategies. The third alternative, which is a complete removal of funding, is not acceptable. The first strategy is to maintain the program at its current funding level, which is $364,000. And this would provide a way to restore lost federal dollars, retain a small staff, and provide a small grants program to communities around the state. And while this is acceptable, it does not allow us to take a proactive approach to combating some of Oregon's current and future problems. The second and more visionary strategy is to grow the program with funding at $1.4 million and help address the changing dynamics taking place on our landscape. It would do that by adding professional staff charged with effectively dealing with issues that include Measure 37 claims, rural and urban issues, pest infestations, forest ownership, drought, wildfires, and climate and global warming. These issues, plus sustaining urban forests and urban trees for all of the health-related benefits mentioned above, are clearly the best choice for all Oregonians. Most people around the world live within urban cities, and Oregon is no exception. So by supporting this issue, you are also supporting your entire constituency, and that is because a healthy urban forest provides benefits to everyone, and that translates to a healthy environment for all. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you. Mr. Fogarty, and if you could limit yourself to 3 minutes, we're...
I will. Thank you. excuse me. My name is Scott Fogarty. I'm executive director with Friends of Trees in Portland, Oregon. And good morning, Chair and members of the subcommittee. I'm here in support of the governor's recommended funding for Oregon Department of Forestry's Urban and Community Forest Program. As executive director of Friends of Trees, which is a Portland-based nonprofit organization with a mission of community building through street tree planting and natural area restoration, I understand firsthand the importance of street trees, park trees, and yard trees in our city and our region. Friends of Trees is a nationally recognized organization and has won several awards for our efforts at maintaining and increasing the canopy cover in the Willamette Valley. The mayor of Portland is fond of saying that he knows he's home because he can see a green carpet stretching from Mount Hood Forest to the sea through the city of Portland because of a lot of our efforts at keeping the canopy alive and healthy. And many of our projects were made possible through Oregon Department of Forestry's Community Assistance Grants, and these grants help our organization plant and maintain the green carpet that we have come to know as Portland. Continued funding of this program will help Friends of Trees deliver and expand our services in Portland, in the four county region, and the Willamette Valley, and the Willamette Valley as a whole. With future funding, or with past funding rather, Friends of Trees has delivered $4 to every $1, which not only includes the $2.70 value that Mr. Snyder mentioned earlier, but also by using volunteer citizens to help with these efforts by matching funds and by other grant funds, and finally by city department savings. you heard a lot of the environmental and health benefits of urban forestry and the urban trees. And I would like to end with just urging you to support this, the government's governor's recommended budget, and to think about how important trees were to you when you were a youth, and think about that first tree that you climbed, or that you built a tree house in, or that you knew in your home or in your school or in your park, and imagine what it would be like without that tree. And so what these urban forestry dollars do is they help build that lasting legacy that has made Oregon well-known as a tree state around the country. Thank you for your consideration of this request and for the opportunity to let me speak in front of you.
Thank you. Thank you both. Christina McNitt, and you wanted to bring up John Papino.
Yes,
and
Senator Devlin, I have a number of members in here that probably couldn't come back, and you see me all the time. I don't know how you're going to handle it. We're going to whip through all these, or
I think we'll be able to make it through if we go quickly. So with you will be John Papino.
Papino.
And if we do 2.5 to 3 minutes, we should make it.
Yeah, with your indulgence, I'm going to read my testimony because that guarantees about 90 seconds a page. So here it goes. For the record, I'm Christina McNitt, representing the Oregon Small Woodlands Association. OSWA is a trade association that represents the private, non-industrial forest landowner that was referenced so many times last week during the department's budget overview. While OSWA's membership hovers around 2,500, this ownership class in Oregon in its entirety is estimated to be more than 40,000 landowners. Who are we? We're typically 65 years old. We're facing issues of generational succession. We have an average of 200 acres or less. We generally manage our forests for a diverse set of values, and we may harvest only once or twice in a generation every 30 years. Our forest land is typically located in lower elevation forests, which include critical riparian areas and provide wildlife corridors among increasingly urbanized settings. 38% of Oregon's forest land is privately held. Of that, non-industrial owners represent almost 50%. OSWA has a strong history of supporting both the Forest Practices Act and the Department of Forestry. As an association, we have two department priorities: first, fire protection, and second, private forests. And with that in mind, I come today with significant concern about the co-chair's budget as it's proposed. Our number one priority has been and continues to be fire protection. But there are two quote-unquote types of fire protection. There's the base protection level and the extraordinary protection for those fires that are unable to be contained with local resources. Extraordinary protection includes the purchase of Oregon's unique fire insurance policy and the reservation of severity resources. Of note, I just have to state in the record again, and you've heard me before, but extraordinary fire protection costs protect Oregon and protect the potential liability for the costs of fighting fire. It does not insure our assets. It does not reimburse landowners for a lifetime of investing in living trees. These items solely protect the general fund from catastrophic costs of fighting fire. While these extraordinary protection resources are identified in the co-chair's budget, they're itemized inside the ODF agency budget itself, rather than noted as a special purpose appropriation under the emergency fund. Allocating funds to the agency budget rather than through the E-Board automatically disqualifies FEMA reimbursements. FEMA reimbursements over the past 5 years have been significant, exceeding $6.5 million in 2004 and $3.5 million in 2005 alone. I told you I had some money for you. So you can see by my chart provided by the Department of Forestry, from 2001 through 2005 are the amounts of FEMA cost reimbursements for our extraordinary fire. And in the past, at least, I think, 10 bienniums, these cost allocations have been through E-Board reservations. And that's why they qualify for reimbursement. It's not insignificant SOFA change. By moving the extraordinary protection items of both insurance and severity from the agency budget to an E-Board SPA, you have the opportunity to recover costs. So that gets to our second priority, and our second concern about the co-chair's budget is not funding the restoration of 13 positions in the private forest program, which would simply restore the department to the essential budget level after reductions incurred over the past 6 years. While these positions were restored in the governor's budget, they were not included in the co-chair's budget, which is before you. These 13 positions are critically important to the functionality of the department's capacity. Historically, the department has been an agency that's seen by landowners and trusted by landowners as the one that facilitates the Forest Practices Act, which, by the way, landowners pay 40% to administer. Without the professional stewardship foresters on the ground with these restorations, they're not assisting landowners, and the agency by necessity moves more towards a regulatory and enforcement relationship with those landowners. This is a historic and negative shift. Unlike agencies such as DEQ that encompass more of a regulatory role by design, ODF can function in part as an economic driver. For a small investment of general funds, less than 4.4% of the state total, there remains a tremendous opportunity to grow the forest sector and increase its contributions to Oregon's social, economic, and environmental values. Based on ODF timber harvest reports, tax revenues generated solely by the non-industrial landowners, so not the large industry holders, in 2006 generated $9,661,176 in Western Oregon and $1,735,328 in Eastern Oregon. It's fair to state that the non-industrial landowners are directly responsible for general fund tax revenues close to $22.3 million per biennium. This estimate doesn't include additional tax revenue generated by economic multiplier effects of income taxes paid by service providers, such as the logging contractors and reforestation contractors. Consideration of that multiplier effect would easily double these numbers. And finally, in addition to our priorities about fire and private forests, we'd like to bring the committee's attention to two policy option packages that were neither included in the governor's recommended budget nor in the co-chair's budget, and that is sudden oak death eradication and the Watershed Research Cooperative. Both are prudent investments because they present an opportunity today that cannot be recovered next biennium. If sudden oak death escapes to the federal forest land management, we've lost the race. And it's going to affect all of us that own private properties. And the Hinkle Creek studies have been ongoing for a number of years, and it would be significantly eroded from a scientific standpoint if they had an eruption to funding. And with that, I have a conclusion, a summary on the bottom, and I'll just let you kind of work through that. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. I guess it's Mr. Papineau.
My name is John Papineau. I'm the President Emeritus of Oregon Small Woodlands Association, and I'm here to support the special purpose appropriation for severity funding for fire protection. The Legislative Emergency Board special purpose appropriation has been established in the last three biennia as explicitly separate from the department's fire protection to keep the department of, or to help the Department of Forestry carry out its fire suppression mission during extreme conditions that exceed the capacity of the budget. To meet the eligibility requirements for FEMA reimbursement, the resource, air tankers, helicopters, engines, etc., cannot be construed to be funded as a regularly budgeted state resource. The expenses are not FEMA eligible if considered as part of the budget, so we're proposing, or we're supporting very much, the special purpose appropriation to put that $6.73 million into the emergency board arena. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you both. Mr. Barnes and Mr. Thayer. And then the final person on deck will be Mr. Springer.
Where'd I go?
Why don't you go ahead and
I'll
start.
Me. He didn't intend to.
Oh, okay.
For the record, Chair Devlin, I'm Mike Barnes. I'm the current president of the Oregon Small Woodlands Association, also a family forest landowner and a consulting forester. And I just briefly like to address the funding of the 13 positions which were recommended by the governor's budget and have been removed under the co-chair's budget. These stewardship foresters, as they are known now, are very important and essential to family forest landowners as we continue to manage and care for our forests. Let me just give you a specific example, and then I'll conclude. Last Friday, I was with a family, a brother and a sister, who are in their 40s and 50s, inherited a piece of property from their father, who had owned it since the early 50s. We noted some things, and they were going through some records of their father. In the late 70s, they had a visit from what was then known as a service forester. Now, this forester made some recommendations to this to their father and how he could enhance their forest lands. That enhancement has resulted 30-some years later in an opportunity to harvest. And this harvest will result in significant tax revenue for the state. This is the kind of service that is being eroded or reduced as a result of reductions in service forestry positions over the past. Service foresters have now been combined with forest practices foresters, and we now know them as stewardship foresters. These stewardship foresters, because of time constraints, are required to take care of those things which legally they must, which is the Forest Practices Act, and are spending less and less time on the service side of things and helping landowners such as this gentleman that I talked to you about. That reduction will continue unless the budget is restored to at least to the levels that we've had historically, and these stewardship foresters are able to offer assistance and building the resources and providing the things that the state desires, not only tax revenues, but water quality, air quality, those other things that come along with good forest stewardship. So I strongly urge you to look at those positions again, restore them as was recommended by the governor's budget. Thank you.
Thank you. And Mr. Springer, if you could paraphrase your testimony, it would be most appreciated.
All right. Thank you very much. Gosh, I've never had the last word before. I hope I'm not. For the record, my name is Gary Springer, and I'm here today on behalf of the Committee for Family Forest Lands, which was a statutorily formed group in 1999 designed to advise the state forester and the Board of Forestry on issues of importance to family forest landowners. Our committee does not support the co-chair's budget. We think it continues what you've heard others refer to already this morning, which is essentially the defunding of the Department of Forestry, and there's a great need, we believe, to rebuild the capacity within the Department of Forestry to get back to at least where they were back in 2000 before we'd seen this downward trend going on and on. I think we do support the governor's proposed budget with a couple of exceptions, and some of those have been mentioned already. The sudden oak death program, eradication program, is really important. I think we have to continue that whether we get support from the federal government or not, or that will, what is now a small problem will become a very big one. Also, the Watershed Research Cooperative is very important. The information that is going to be gathered there from those research sites in Western Oregon will be vital, I believe, to inform the Forest Practices Act and make sure that we're making right decisions. The Board of Forestry is making right decisions about the Forest Practices Act changes in the future. And I will just close, I guess, with a quote from the Forestry Program for Oregon, which is our state's comprehensive policy document for all of Oregon's forest lands. Oregon will have adequate funding for the Department of Forestry to efficiently and cost-effectively accomplish the mission and strategies of the Board of Forestry and department personnel policies that encourage and recognize employees, allowing them to meet their full potential in providing excellent public service. It's the opinion of the Committee for Family Forest Lands that we have not been living up to that vision statement the past 6 years, and it is time to reverse that underfunding trend rather than to continue it as the co-chair's budget does.
Any questions? Seeing none. Thank you both very much. Thank everyone for coming today. I will close the hearing on House Bill 5024. Mr. Brown, we will see you back tomorrow morning and your staff, and we will be able to finish up tomorrow with the hearing portion of this discussion. And with that, we are adjourned.